Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Comment ma fille et moi pouvons-nous définir qui peut lui envoyer des messages? Comment parler avec mon fils des bons comportements à adopter en ligne? Si vous avez des questions sur la sécurité de vos ados en ligne, vous trouverez des ressources utiles dans le Centre Familial Instagram. Le Centre Familial vous permet de paramétrer la supervision parentale avec votre ado. Et dans l'espace éducation, vous trouverez des conseils d'experts pour discuter de sécurité. Découvrez nos outils pour la famille sur instagram.com/outils-pour-la-famille.
Ever wondered what the world's wealthiest people did to get so ridiculously rich? Our billionaire this episode is the founder of co-working company WeWork, Adam Neumann.
At its peak, WeWork was worth $47 billion. And Adam had a lot of fun getting to that point. He spent $20,000 on tequila and made people do shots during business meetings.
His modest aspirations, including wanting to live forever, to become the world's first trillionaire and expand his company to Mars. What we learned in the last couple of weeks is, in reality, he oversaw one of the most spectacular business failures in modern history. So is he good, bad, or just another billionaire?
To find out, listen to Good Bad Billionaire wherever you get your podcasts.
It's exhilarating. It's like driving a car under an avalanche, but you're taunting the avalanche rather than trying to get away from it.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 7th of November, these are our main stories. Israel's Prime Minister says his country will take over security responsibility for Gaza for an indefinite period. As the peace dialogue in Ethiopia falters, there's been another outbreak of fighting in the Amhara region. And Charles III delivers the first King's Speech to Parliament in more than seven decades. Also in this podcast, love letters to French sailors during the Seven Years' War, made public now after being forgotten for more than two and a half centuries.
The British Naval Administration set these letters aside on the assumption that they would forward them to the prisoner crew. And then either through lack of time or incompetence, they were forgotten.
And how an Argentine penguin colony is astonishingly thriving thanks to the efforts of conservationists. But first, it's exactly 1 month since fighters from Hamas, which controls Gaza, launched a series of surprise attacks on Israel, killing over 1,400 people and kidnapping more than 200. The Israeli military response has been massive and sustained, a ground operation in Gaza and almost daily airstrikes. Israel says it's targeting Hamas infrastructure in the Palestinian enclave. But the number of civilian deaths is rising, more than 10,000, according to the Hamas-run health ministry, many of them children. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, remains defiant. In an interview with the American network ABC, he said there would be no ceasefire without the release of Israeli hostages. And he gave an indication about what might happen after the fighting ends.
I think Israel will, for an indefinite period, will have the overall security responsibility, because we've seen what happens when we don't have it. When we don't have that security responsibility, what we have is the eruption of Hamas terror on a scale that we couldn't imagine.
I asked our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yoland Nell, why Mr. Netanyahu was saying this now.
I mean, he was talking to the American network ABC. He still rejected a ceasefire, despite all the international calls for that, but did say that Israel would consider tactical little pauses in fighting to allow aid to enter in or hostages to exit. This is very much what Washington has been speaking about. But then there has been this question raised. We know it's been some point of US diplomacy, as Antony Blinken was just here traveling around the region. And the question about what will happen when this war is over. I mean, there's been speculation, could there be a role for the UN or for Israel's foreign allies, for the Palestinian Authority, which of course is a political rival to Hamas. It governs parts of the occupied West Bank. And when I've spoken to officials from there, they've said they couldn't go back to Gaza on the back of an Israeli tank. What the Israeli Prime Minister seems to be talking about here is a new Israeli occupation, saying Israel will have overall security responsibility. Of course, the great likelihood is that there would be huge Palestinian resistance to that.
Can you give us the latest on the Israeli operations in Gaza?
We've had one of these sort of regular updates from the Israeli military where they said that they took hold of a Hamas stronghold in the northern Gaza Strip, have actually put out aerial videos which they say show that. They say that they located anti-tank missiles there, launchers, other weapons and intelligence. They've talked about Hamas fighters in Gaza City using a building close to a Quds hospital where we know there are lots of people sheltering. Are they saying that was the place that they were trying to launch attacks from and that there was a strike on there? But what we're also hearing, what I'm not able to get any comment from the Israeli military, is big strikes in Khan Yunis and Rafah in the very south of the Gaza Strip, with local health officials talking about at least 23 people killed in these separate airstrikes. And there's very dramatic footage that shows once again children's bodies being pulled from the rubble, children being pulled alive as well, but really quite devastating strikes on what appear to be family homes.
Yeah, I'm looking at pictures of Gaza at the moment and huge plumes of smoke right across the skyline. A minute's silence observed in Israel. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's sort of an unofficial day of mourning. It's 1 month on now from those attacks, the deadliest day in Israel's 75-year history. We've seen people dressed in black. It was a call from the families of the people who were killed that day for others to come out. And just to remember, with just 1 minute of silence, what happened. There are memorial services taking place at some schools and at universities, many flags flying at half-mast, and more events are planned through the day, including actually a protest outside the Israeli Parliament. There are also calls coming up from the families of those 240 hostages who remain inside Gaza for more to be done to bring their loved ones home.
Yoland Nell in Jerusalem. As we mentioned earlier, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that Israel will assume overall security responsibility for the territory once the war is over. But what will that mean in practice? Our chief international editor Jeremy Bowen has this assessment.
Overall security responsibility is a phrase that's used in part of the West Bank, which is the other area of the Palestinian territories. And in that, under the Oslo agreements back in the 1990s, so we're talking almost of a historical document here, but there was one of those areas was Palestinian municipal control and Israeli security responsibility. So in other words, they would come and go as they pleased in terms of arresting, enforcing, shooting, but the more mundane workaday things would, you know, collecting rubbish, running the schools, that sort of stuff, would be done by Palestinians. But to do that, of course, you need a Palestinian body that is prepared to work with the Israelis. And of course, after everything that's happened, I think the chances are that any Palestinian who tried to do that would be regarded as a quisling. So I do think that while that might be a sort of vague aspiration for Israel, the fact is they are, you know, they are going to be in a very difficult position because of the fact that they are stuck now, if you like, with Gaza. They're going to have to deal with it, and I think it will involve an occupation. It's going to have to.
Jeremy Bowen. For the civilian population in Gaza, the situation continues to deteriorate. Humanitarian aid is only trickling into Gaza, and shortages are becoming acute. Juliet Toomer is from the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA.
Our UNRWA shelters are really overflowing with people. They're holding four times more of the capacity that they were planned to do. We are at a situation where in some places 50 women and girls are sharing one classroom and men and boys are forced to sleep outside in the open in the schoolyard, sleeping sometimes on the floor because we also ran out of mattresses.
And the number of casualties in Gaza is rising alarmingly. The World Health Organization says more than 160 children are being killed in the territory every day. It's criticized attacks on healthcare facilities, but Israel insists such strikes are legitimate, accusing Hamas of using hospitals and ambulances to mount attacks. Fergal Keane has more on the plight of children in Gaza.
They cannot choose what they witness. The deaths of others and the grief of their elders. Thousands have died. Farah Hassan was 2.5 years old and was killed by an airstrike on October 27th. She came late in the life of her parents, Abir and Mohammed, reaching now for the comfort of memory.
I felt as if I held the entire world in my hands, eagerly anticipating her arrival, cherishing every moment until she took her first breath. I nurtured her with utmost care as she grew. The first time I heard her voice, I couldn't believe it. She breathed life into my world. She filled my whole world.
For 4 weeks now, our journalists in Gaza have recorded the impact of the war on its children. Those who survive live with the trauma. But there is another story that speaks of Gaza's children and a longing for joy. 12 years ago, they created a world record for kite flying, a transcendent moment. And even now, amid all the war has taken, there is also resilience. Children making worlds of their own within the war. 12-year-old Leanne Khalaf finds comfort in her family when the bombing starts. My mom calls my brothers and sisters to hug them, she says, and we hold each other's hands. In the grounds of Al-Aqsa Hospital, staff and the children of refugees. Surgical gloves make little balloons. In another part of the hospital, more of Gaza's children were being mourned. Little Mariam Al-Masri.
How will I go home without you, my beloved? How will I go back without you, my darling?
Fergal Keane with that report. Other stories now. The G7's support for Ukraine isn't going anywhere. That's the firm advice from Japan as foreign ministers from the wealthy nations bloc plus the EU meet in Tokyo. Since the outbreak of the Israel-Hamas war, the G7 has issued just one statement on the ongoing war after Russia's invasion. Speaking to journalists in Tokyo, Britain's Foreign Secretary James Cleverly insisted the bloc wanted to see humanitarian pauses in Gaza, though he insisted the G7 has seen nothing from Hamas to say they're serious about a ceasefire. A group of anti-war protesters gathered in Tokyo near the venue, waving Palestinian flags and flanked by police. This woman explained why she was there.
We get so much tragic news every day, more than anything else. I decided to come today not because I don't or do understand the political situation or anything about the Middle East, but because I thought if there's a place where I can disagree as a human being, then I should attend.
I got the latest from our Tokyo correspondent, Shaima Khalil. I asked her what the Japanese and British diplomats had been saying.
I think the focus is on really three main points: the security in the Indo-Pacific, the four ministers, the foreign secretary, the defense secretary of the UK, but also their Japanese counterparts have essentially been in unison in saying that the partnership between the two countries is really, really strong. I asked Grant Shapps, the British Defence Secretary, whether the wars, whether it's the Ukraine war or the Middle East war, could distract Britain and Japan's allies from security in the Indo-Pacific. And he said, absolutely not. The fact that we're here is proof of that. But I think on the war in Ukraine, again, there's been concern that it's almost been, as it's going on, it hasn't been given the attention. And I think, again, the four ministers were saying that despite all that's going on, they continue to support Ukraine's right to defend itself. And they say that they will continue to oppose sanctions on Russia, as well as being in contact with the Ukrainian foreign minister during the sessions of the G7 foreign ministers meeting.
Is there anything they can actually do?
They will continue sanctions on Russia. What's interesting is that the defense secretary was asked about Russian diamonds. If you remember back in May, during the G7 leadership summit, there was an announcement about sanctions on Russian diamonds, the diamond trade, and that it was going to come into place at the end of the year. We haven't heard any more details about that. And from what we've heard today, I don't think we'll get an announcement on that. I think what they want to say, again, as a united front, is that they haven't forgotten about their commitment towards Ukraine. They haven't forgotten about Russia, despite most of the attention now being on the Middle East.
Shaima Khalil in Tokyo. Charles III has delivered his first King's Speech to Parliament in London, marking the start of the parliamentary year amid pomp and pageantry. It's the first such speech since the death of Queen Elizabeth last year, and the King began the formal ceremony with a personal tribute.
It is mindful of a legacy of service and devotion to this country set by my beloved mother, the late Queen, that I deliver this, the first King's speech, in over 70 years.
Our political correspondent Rob Watson was there and told me about the atmosphere.
Do you know, you're struck by two things, Alex, and I was lucky enough to have a real kind of close-up seat. I could have almost got the King a cup of tea and the Queen a coffee. So you're sort of struck by the realisation that the page of history really has turned in this country. Queen Elizabeth is no longer here after such a long reign. But you're also sort of struck by the amazing continuity, of course, of the monarchy as now represented by King Charles. So that, if you like, is the sort of social history bit. I mean, the other bit that I was struck by is that, you know, politics also rumbles on, Alex. And in this case, you know, you have a government hoping that after 13 years in office, the speech that was read out by the King on the government's behalf still has sort of something to offer to the British voters before an election sometime in the next year or so.
What are the main takeaways, though, from what he said?
So I think, look, the main takeaway from the speech is that this is a government that is, as you would expect, it's a Conservative government. It's sort of making an appeal to voters on the right by saying, you know, we're going to be tougher on crime. We'd be the ones who are going to be tough on immigration. But of course, the problem that the government faces is that 13 years I just mentioned. I mean, the sort of natural human instinct is to say, well, hang on a minute, if you had any good ideas, you've been in power for 13 years, why on earth haven't you done them? So I suspect that even the government doesn't really think that a sort of speech, which was very much a sort of steady as she goes rather than a radical programme, would make much difference. I mean, it seems to me, Alex, the government is so far behind in the opinion polling that really the only thing that would say them at this point is, you know, some unforecast upturn in the UK economy or maybe the main opposition Labour Party imploding over some other issue or another. But the government knows it's really up against it. It's those 13 years.
It was quite interesting watching the King's face, particularly as he detailed the government's environmental policies.
Yes, I'm sure there'll be all sorts of people in this country and beyond thinking, well, we all know that King Charles is an early advocate of, or early warner against climate change, dangers to biodiversity. So you were thinking that when he read out the government saying that it was going to be, you know, more open-minded about the idea of more gas and oil exploration in the North Sea off the UK coast, that maybe that wouldn't be his cup of tea. But again, you know, it's a reminder of the whole constitutional monarchy thing, right, Alex? That no matter what the King or the Queen before him thinks about the government's policies, my goodness, they keep a straight face.
Our political correspondent, Rob Watson. Still to come in this podcast, how the reluctance of Chinese tourists to visit hurts the Thai economy.
Ever wondered what the world's wealthiest people did to get so ridiculously rich? Our billionaire this episode is the founder of co-working company WeWork, Adam Newman.
At its peak, WeWork was worth $47 billion. And Adam had a lot of fun getting to that point. He spent $20,000 on tequila and made people do shots during business meetings.
His modest aspirations, including wanting to live forever, to become the world's first trillionaire and expand his company to Mars. What we learned in the last couple of weeks is, in reality, he oversaw one of the most spectacular business failures in modern history. So is he good, bad, or just another billionaire?
To find out, listen to Good Bad Billionaire wherever you get your podcasts.
Suddenly my quilt is ripped off me and then my room is full of white men. And I thought, I'm done for. These are fascists. They found where I live.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe.
Betrayal. It runs through my life and runs through my story.
I was just all alone in this vast, broken system.
I never gave up my dream.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
To East Africa now. Despite calls from the international community for greater dialogue in Ethiopia, there has been another outbreak of fighting in the Amhara region, with troops from the Ethiopian government clashing once again with militias that they've been battling in the region since August. To find out more, Davina Gupta spoke to our reporter Kalkadan Yibultal in Addis Ababa.
It seems that the violence has not stopped. We have been seeing these sporadic clashes in pocket areas, but now it seems that there is a major operation underway. What the militias claiming is that the government is launching these offensives, trying to regain full control of the region. The most intense fighting was reported, as you said, in August. At that time, the militias managed to enter most of the region's main cities. They even briefly controlled an airport. After that, the government, you know, launched these offensives and pushed them out of these cities. But they have continued to operate in rural areas and smaller towns, and they have claimed controlling some of the region's smaller towns and then rural villages. So now it seems there is an effort to try to push them out from there as well. But we haven't had any statement from the government, so we don't know what is going on from their side. The militias are saying that there's an attack against them and they are thwarting that attack.
What's the impact of this on the internal security also of Ethiopia, which recently saw an end to a civil war in the Tigray region and is trying to rebuild?
It has quite a significant impact for the country's security, for the country's economy as well. As you said, the brutal civil war in Tigray ended a year ago, and that region is still reeling from the impacts of the war. We haven't had much construction and rebuilding because there are other, you know, ongoing conflicts like this one. And now in this region, in Amhara, which is the second largest in Ethiopia, which is home to more than 25 million people, we're witnessing this insecurity, this instability, and it's sure going to have a tremendous impact on the country.
What can be then a possible solution at this stage?
Well, there have been calls from quite a number of Western states, including the US and the UK, in recent weeks calling for dialogue or trying to resolve the issues through discussions with these militias. But that doesn't seem to be on the horizon right now. For one thing, these militias are not an organized armed group under one command. There seems to be operating under different smaller and fragmented groups. And the government is saying that they're basically outlaws. So we're not seeing signs of trying to resolve this issue through dialogue.
The BBC's Kalkadan Yibultal in Addis Ababa. Few large countries are as dependent on tourism as Thailand. The Thai economy was hit very hard by the COVID restrictions, and Thais had hoped that 2023 would be the year that saw their tourist economy bounce back. That, though, has not happened, largely because the Chinese, who make up one quarter of the 40 million foreign visitors who arrived in Thailand in 2019, have not come back, at least not in the same numbers. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head has been finding out why.
'76 Garage is a Bangkok restaurant with a difference. At around 8 in the evening, the waiters, all fit young men, strip down to their shorts and wade into a pool, offering to carry the customers, nearly all of them Chinese tourists, in their arms to have their photos taken. There was a time when you had to book a month in advance to eat here. but these days half the tables are empty. Abby, a Chinese student in Thailand, vlogs about places like 76 Garage to her thousands of social media followers. Recently, she spotted alarming rumours circulating on her feed. People are claiming that the restaurant is actually a front, luring unsuspecting Chinese diners into having their kidneys removed.
The comments on my feed used to be very positive. Many said they really wanted to come to Thailand. But after these rumours started spreading, the comments changed completely. People would ask me, are you running the kidney harvesting scam? Are you sending people from Thailand to Myanmar?
These wild rumours have been fuelled by the very real problem of scam centres operating along Thailand's borders. This film, No More Bets, which dramatises the fate of Chinese citizens trapped in these scam centres, was a huge hit in China over the summer. Freewheeling, fun-loving Thailand suddenly started to look unsafe. The Thai government has responded to these scares by waiving visas for Chinese nationals. It organised this welcome ceremony for new arrivals at the airport, hosted by the new Prime Minister. But then another setback. Last month, a 14-year-old boy opened fire inside Bangkok's most famous shopping mall, killing three people, among them a mother of two visiting from China. These headwinds are holding back a much-needed recovery in Thailand's tourism. This frustrated guide at the Grand Palace in Bangkok says his government must have been dreaming when it promised that tourism would be back to normal this year. Gary Bowerman, whose company Check In Asia tracks the travel industry in the region, says it's not just because of safety fears.
I think there are a number of reasons, but I think the primary one is going back to January, you know, when China did reopen. It's done it in a very phased way. The government has controlled the reopening, particularly for the group tour market, which is quite important to Thailand. That's been slowed right down.
And those who are still traveling to Thailand are changing. Gone are the days when the Chinese came mostly in large, noisy groups.
We are pushing for more quality. We don't want just numbers.
Tirawan Techa Ubon, whose family company Kasemkit operates a chain of luxury hotels and serviced apartments, says she's starting to see a wealthier kind of Chinese traveller.
They are more open to more experience. They spend a lot on food, on activities. Like in Samui, we have this hotel on our private island, 24 villas. And we have a lot of Chinese that buy out the whole island for birthday, for weddings, and even for proposals.
There are now so many other niches in the huge and fast-changing Chinese market that Thailand will have to attract to sustain its all-important tourist industry.
Jonathan Head in Bangkok. Wartime letters written to French sailors in the 18th century and confiscated by the Royal Navy have been opened for the first time. The letters, bound with a ribbon, have been gathering dust in a storage unit, as Justine Green reports.
The letters, written in 1757 and 1758, were intended for the crew of the French warship the Galatea. Wives, fiancés, parents and siblings sent the missives to their loved ones, but they never reached them. The ship was captured by the British and the letters ended up in storage. A Cambridge University academic, Professor Renaud Moyer, unearthed a collection of 104 letters from the National Archives at Kew. He believes officials opened two of them to see if they had any military value, but decided they just contained family stuff and put them away.
The British Naval Administration, the Admiralty, set these letters aside on the assumption that they would forward them to the prisoner crew. And then either through lack of time or incompetence or simply because they couldn't find these prisoners who were dispatched to various English prisons, they were forgotten. And there they remained for over 250 years.
The notes make for fascinating reading, with one wife writing, "I could spend the night writing to you," and another, "I cannot wait to possess you." Professor Morier says they're not unique to France or the 18th century and reveal how we all cope when separated from loved ones.
Justine Green. And finally, to a success story in the world of penguins. In the last decade and a half, the 12 penguins who lived at the El Pedral colony in Argentina have grown to 8,000, thanks to the work of conservationists. Among them is Dr. Pablo Borboroglu. He's been teaching others how to do this at a biodiversity summit in London, and also spoke to my colleague Michelle Hussein.
So when we first discovered this colony 15 years ago, there were six pairs of nests. They were exploring, prospecting, looking for a safe and secure place to nest, you know. But it was a mess because there were reckless people visiting the area. They were throwing garbage everywhere. They would go with dogs that were a threat for penguins. Also, they would make barbecues and setting bushes on fire where the penguins were nesting. And of course, there was a lot of human disturbance because not everybody respects penguins as we think. So there was also a problem with plastic pollution, you know, coming from the fisheries, but also from these reckless people. So we started to protect the colony and restricting the access of these people. But it was not easy because we have a lot of incidents with army trespassers and vandalism. But then we knew that we had to protect it. And then penguins responded because the colony started to grow. And from those six, the next season we have 40 and 70 and 500. And then we implemented an ecotourism operation. We helped the landowners to do that. So that generated jobs and incomes for the local community. So people perceived that a live penguin was much useful for them, you know.
So it sounds like the first thing was actually sealing off the area to making it a no-go area for humans.
Exactly, because the colony could have disappeared in one afternoon. You know, with only six pairs, if a dog would kill them all, that would be it. But we also needed penguins to feel safe in that area. So we implemented a management plan, and then we implemented a lot of educational activities. We took kids to remove all the plastics from the beach and from the nesting area, different activities in terms of education. So people perceive that they could be part. And this is part of what we are sharing now at the Whitley Fund for Nature Summit that we're having this week. We're all coming here to share our stories. And at the beginning, you are so right, because you were facing, you know, these people coming with guns, cutting the fences to trespass, trying to do what they've been doing forever. So we work with the government and with the landowners to implement, to create a wildlife refuge. So with that kind of level of formal protection, help us to, you know, stop these people from coming in. And now, as you said, we have 8,000 breeders. So the sound that we just heard is what you hear in the morning when penguins are leaving to the ocean to get food, and also in the afternoon. So penguins, they don't thank you, but you feel that, you know, in the air, because when you are there, it's a fantastic moment. Yeah. And it's one of the most amazing wildlife spectacles on the planet.
That was the conservationist Dr. Pablo Borboroglu. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Pat Sissons, and the producer was Oliver Burlow. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.